Welcome back to Behavioral Science for Brands, a podcast where we look at the connections between academics and practical marketing. Every other week, Richard and I sit down and look at the behavioral science that's powering some of America's most popular brands. This week, however, we're doing Valentine's Day. Sex, lies, and survey data. We're looking at the industry that's around Valentine's Day, online dating, and most importantly, what we can learn from the data that comes out of online dating. I'm Michael Aaron Flicker.
And I'm Richard Shorten.
Let's get into it. So Richard, we're talking Valentine's Day. We're talking all of the love and heart palpitations that may surround it. And we're also talking about data and what we can learn from it. Expected spend this year, $26 billion globally.
It's a lot of roses.
It's a lot of roses. In fact, the average American will spend $192 celebrating, recognizing Valentine's Day in the upcoming year. So it's really a very interesting holiday, just because we all love facts. We all love history on this podcast. First recorded connection between Valentine's Day and romance was Geoffrey Chaucer of the Canterbury Tales back in 1415. And then Shakespeare latches onto this. Other famous writers continue to build the lore around Valentine's Day. But letter writing and writing of cards really didn't first start occurring till the American Revolution. That's what I call it. What do you call the American Revolution?
I would, of course, call it the American Revolution out of respect, not the Traitors' War.
Right.
I would never say that.
Right, yeah. Right. So depending on which side of the pond you are on, you have a different view of that war. And then from there, it really picks up steam until really the 19th century, when it starts to become a fully recognized holiday and much more to it. But it's a big holiday with lots happening. And it got you and me thinking, what's the behavioral science angle we could take on this holiday? And the study published in 2017 shows the difference in how U.S. couples first meet. In 1995, 33% of Americans meet in setups in person, and that's down to now 20% in 2017. Whereas online dating was 2% in 1995, it is now up to 39%. So we see this massive drop off of, you know, in-person introduction, serendipitous meetings, and a massive rise in online dating. And that's really interesting, because what we have with online dating is a lot of data and a lot of both experiments and a lot of learnings from how people search for their match and for what they do when they are matched and when they find a first date. So we thought this was fertile ground to really dive deep and think about behavioral science through this lens.
Yeah, it's a brilliant area, because previously, if you've asked people about their love life, you have to rely on what they tell you.
Right.
The advent of online dating gives you this treasure trove of data. And people like Christian Rudder at OkCupid have catalogued some of those insights and published them. So they're available now to analyze.
Yeah, yeah. And so just a teaser of some of these amazing things that we see. OkCupid released data of 1.5 million men's profiles. And what they did was they mapped the zip code data of heights of all men in that zip code. And then they looked at the OkCupid professed heights of the men in that area. And would you know it? It's an exact same bell curve, but 2 inches taller for their claimed height versus their statistically likely height.
Yes, they're lying, but not lying so much that they are embarrassed when they actually meet their date.
It's almost too perfect of a curve to be anything other than intentional.
And this is if that was a one-off, it'd be a quirk, but there's not much we could learn from it.
Yeah.
But a theme of dating is that what people say is very different from reality. So in that case, it's exaggerating height. There's another study in the UK, which is done by UCL, so a very respected university. They sample 15,000 people every 10 years, and they publish a survey called NatSal. And one of the questions they ask people, and this bit of data I'm going to talk about is just for heterosexual people, it's how many sexual partners have you had? And the interesting thing is, maths and logic says the number for men and the number for women must be the same.
If it's a heterosexual questionnaire. Yep.
Exactly. Oh, well, this particular question. And what they find, though, is men claim 12 sexual partners back in 2010 to 2012. Women claim 8. So there is a discrepancy. Now, we don't know whether men are exaggerating or women are under-exaggerating, but we know that people are lying. And that's something to think about, because so much in marketing relies on taking people's word at face value. But what we see from OkCupid, what we see from NatSal, is lies are the norm. Now, there's one other study that might be worth quickly mentioning. It comes from a brilliant book called Everybody Lies, written by Seth Stevens Davidovits. It was published, I think, in 2017. And he was originally an analyst at Google. And what he does is compare what are the most common terms people use to describe their husband on social media. And it's things like amazing, the best, brilliant. And then he does exactly the same process, but looks at search data and looks at what are the most common words people use to describe or search about their husbands. And it's things like annoying, mean, a jerk, gay. There is a completely different set of attributes that you would believe reflected relationships if you took social listening at face value, or if you looked at the propensity of various different search terms. You know, social media is the image that we project to the world. Search is, I think, in Davidovits's words, it's like a modern day confessional. This is what we actually are thinking when we think no one's watching us. So there's again a point here of one of the data sets that marketers use all the time, you know, going out, listening to what people talk about their brands online. It's not necessarily a representation of what people think. It's a representation of what they want the world to think they think. That might be useful, but it's a very different thing.
Yeah, it might be useful and it can be powerful depending on how you use it, but you've got to be aware of this distinction.
Exactly. If you interpret those statements through that lens, very, very powerful. If you interpret it thinking that people are giving you the unvarnished truth, big problem.
Yeah. Yeah. And you know, we have talked a lot about this over the years, but something worth highlighting here, this is a very similar problem to asking people in quant or qual studies what they want versus looking at what they actually do, right? I mean, it's the problem of projective polling or just looking at claim data.
Yeah, you're right. This isn't just something that affects people's love life. There are a number of behavioral science studies that suggest there are problems with what people tell you. So one of the famous ones comes from Adrian North, who's at the University of Leicester, and he works for the British supermarket, and he persuades this supermarket to play music in the wine aisle.
Yeah,
sometimes it's German, sometimes it's French, and they alternate days or times when it's French music, days and times when it's German music. And North monitors sales of the wine from those two countries. And what he finds is that, and I won't get the numbers exactly right, but when the French music is playing, say roughly 3/4 of the wine from those two countries is French, 25% German. When the German music is playing, it's say 60% German, 40% French. What he shows is that a tiny change in the environment has a really big
outsized impact
on sales. But the bit that should interest us for this episode is what he does next. As people are leaving the supermarket, he stops them, asks them if they've bought wine. If they say yes, he asks them, have you bought any French or German wine? And if they say yes again, he says, why did you buy that wine? And only 2% of people spontaneously mention the music. So we know it was a big impact, but no one's mentioning it. More worryingly still is that when he prompts people and says, look, did the music influence you? 86% of people flat out deny it had any influence at all. So his argument is there are two problems with claims data. This is what people say in focus groups or they say in surveys. Either people lie. They
intentionally.
Intentionally lie. Exactly. Intentionally lie. They know the truth, but they don't want to tell you. And I think that's what's happening with the OkCupid data and the NatCell data.
That'd be the how many sexual partners you had or how tall you are.
Exactly. Yeah, most of us know roughly our height.
Yeah.
Yeah. But the other problem is he says people confabulate. So the argument here is sometimes people try and tell you the truth when you're in a focus group or answering a survey. But the argument goes that they don't know their own motivations, so they can't tell the actual reason. They're trying to be honest, but they end up giving misleading answers. And that's what psychologists mean when they say this term, confabulate. So there's a couple of brilliant statements from psychologists. Jonathan Haidt says, well, you know, we think the rational mind is the Oval Office when it's actually the press office. It's not, we're not actually making all these decisions. What we're doing is just giving plausible stories about why they happened.
Or explaining it.
Yeah. Or Timothy Wilson says, people are strangers to themselves. They don't have full introspective insight to their motivations.
And when I first heard the wine and music study, I understood it academically, but I don't think that I fully internalized the learning. When we went through the material today to be ready for talking about online dating and the heights and the sexual partners, I think it struck home for me that this is – it's really personal. It's not just purchase decisions. It's how I see myself. It's how I see my relationships. It's how I see the world. So this is a deep-seated way that people understand their own motivation and behaviors.
Yeah, there's sometimes a misnomer that behavioral science biases just affects consumers, but they absolutely affect us in our personal lives.
Yeah.
And something we haven't talked about much recently, they affect us in our professional decisions as well. In fact, that area might be one of the most interesting because if consumers are unwilling to mention that they are influenced by supposedly irrational drives of behavior, professionals are even more keen to deny that.
So just to round out this part of the discussion, if we now have established that this is true – And at least through a behavioral science lens, it seems very obvious that the data supports this. What are marketers to do? So if you believe that claim data can be flawed for either of the two reasons, intentional lying or confabulation, what should marketers do?
That's a great question because I don't want to just set up a problem
and not solve
wash your hands of it. Yeah. The best solution is to think of the Adrian North study in the supermarket. He actually, I did edit out, but he did it with a partner called Hargreaves. So it's North and Hargreaves, I should have said. They, when they set up the experiment and monitored the initial results, they ran what psychologists call a field experiment. They get a naturalistic setting, a supermarket, representative audience, people coming into that supermarket, they don't know they're taking part in an experiment. They then set up two scenarios. In each scenario, the basic level of features are exactly the same. Same selection of wines, same prices, but they change one variable between the two settings.
Right.
In this case, the music. And then any change in purchasing, you can attribute back to that single change variable. That approach for field experiment, which they did in store, but you could do on your website, you could do it in your network of cafes or restaurants, whatever business you have, that approach of test versus control is much more accurate than asking people how they think they'd behave in an artificial situation.
Very helpful. So you can set up your own experiments to prove or disprove hypotheses. There also is a growing set of research firms that seek to give insight into action, not just claimed motivation. I don't know them all very well, but this is a growing field of research.
Yeah, and in fact, every single survey provider can run something called a Mnemonic test.
Yeah, right.
I don't think it's as good as a field experiment, but it's pretty darn close. And what you do there is randomize survey participants into one of two groups. You give them a setup, same basic setup between the two groups, but you change again one single variable. That might sound a bit abstract, so I'll give an example that you and I have done. we recruited 282 people. We told them about Sierra Nevada Pale Ale costing $18.99 for a 12-pack. And we asked people how good value that was. And I think it was 13% thought it was good or great value. Then got another set of people, showed them exactly the same picture of the beer, the same price, the same volume, but we added a couple of extra words. That's the same as $1.58 a bottle. And we saw that the proportion who thought it was good or great value more than doubled to 27%. That's a very basic monadic test. People do not see the two options. They just see one of them. And it gets a much more realistic response. Because if you did the normal approach of showing people the two prices, the audience...
And asked what they would...
Yeah. The audience would laugh at you. They'd say, it's the same thing. I would treat them exactly the same. But if you split people into cells, you split people into groups, and you run this monadic approach, that flushes out some of these smaller, quirkier influences on behavior.
Wonderful. Wonderful. All right. So we're having some interesting conversation. Let's head to a break. When we come back, we'll talk a little bit more about data and what we're going to do with it.
Behavioral Science for Brands is brought to you by Function Growth, AdAge's newcomer agency of the year. Function Growth uses behavioral science to supercharge growth for direct-to-consumer brands. Delivering a wide spectrum of services, they are the one-stop shop for brands with high growth potential. Tired of agencies that make money when you don't? Function Growth's shared risk and reward model means they only make money when your brand grows. Discover how Function Growth can unlock the power of behavioral science to accelerate growth for your brand today.
So, Richard, we've talked about a lot of interesting aspects about claim data versus actual behavior, and we talked about where we've been. Before we get to concluding, could you highlight some of the big takeaways from today's episode?
I think there's two big takeaways. The first is, as marketers, we should have a greater skepticism towards claim data. We should recognize that people either lie directly, they answer in a way that projects a positive image, or they confabulate. They try and tell you the truth, but because they don't know their own motivations, they end up being misleading. So the first thing is to be more skeptical about claim data.
Mm-hmm.
The second point is not to indulge in a council of despair, but to recognize there are many alternatives to claim data. Think about how you can behave like a psychological behavioral scientist. Can you use a field experiment or can you use a monadic test? And those simple techniques will give you a much better guide to what genuinely motivates people. And if you base your marketing on learnings from those techniques, you're more likely to be basing your marketing on sound psychological principles.
Very, very helpful. Over the course of today's conversation, we've talked about a number of different resources and books that help flesh out this concept. We'll put them in the show notes, but do you want to just talk to one or two of the books we think folks may find interesting?
I think there's two that stand out. There's Everybody Lies by Seth Stevens-Davidovits. His argument is learning from analyzing social media means that you are learning from analyzing the image that people want to project. His argument is analyzing search data is a much more accurate guide to people's genuine feelings.
Mm-hmm.
Because he argues in surveys or what you post online, if you lie, you still get positive benefits. You get a better image, for example. But when you're searching for things, you have to put what you genuinely think.
Or you won't have the discovery.
Exactly. So he argues that is a very, very valuable guide to unlocking people's genuine feelings. The second book that I think is absolutely brilliant is one called Dataclism. It's where we got the OKCupid data from. Christian Rudder was one of the founders of OKCupid. I think he was the CTO after that. And he originally posted lots of blogs. And I think he had the tagline of something, how people behave when they think no one's looking.
Mm.
He put that all together in a very, very interesting book called Dataclism. And it's essentially what you can learn about human nature from analyzing what people do on dating sites.
So helpful. So helpful. So we'll drop the links below. We'll make sure that folks can find those if there's of interest. So as we're coming to a close, since we set this up as a episode on Valentine's Day, and we have detoured folks yeah. around the world of data and dating, I thought I might bring a final book recommendation to the table that's a little bit more centered on love and finding love. This comes from Arthur Brooks. He is a Harvard professor, and his most recent book, he co-authored with Oprah Winfrey, called Finding the Life You Want. And in it, he makes an argument that what we should seek in the world in a romantic partner is a complement, not a mirror. So rather than finding someone who is exactly like you and matches all the things that you say that you are and that you want, finding someone who is not exactly your same, but finding someone who complements the way you are leads to greater happiness. And again, this is his life's work, is studying happiness. It's a super interesting, compelling point. And it ties back to what we've talked about today, because if you use online dating to only find your exact match, your exact mirror, you might not live as happy a life as if you find someone who's your complement.
Yeah, I think that's an interesting one. That data around online dating probably has huge social effects, because if there was an era when you dated people you met at the church or a bar, there's an element of luck. You know,
that's right.
You are attracted to someone through their looks or their charisma or their humor. That's the thing that grabs you, not their background or interests.
Education, income.
Yes.
Yeah.
So the danger is online dating. We put in what we think we're going to be attracted to or think's going to work for us. Whereas when it was at the bar or the church, there was an element of serendipity.
That's right. Mm. That's right. And as we've asked before, Richard, love to hear from our listeners on social media, through the website. If you have comments, questions, things you'd like us to cover, please let us know. And until next time, I'm Michael Aaron Flicker.
And I'm Richard Shotton.